Nobody has questions.
How long of a class time will we have to do this?
So the quiz.
You can ask me questions.
The quiz is intended to be short, I think it's 15 minutes. So it's like a 7-minute quiz, for which you have 15 minutes. The only purpose of the quiz is that, it used to be that everybody got very nervous because of the final exam. So we started giving a midterm exam. Then everybody got very nervous because it was a midterm exam, so we started giving a quiz. Right, so the question, how do you prepare for the midterm exam? We've never seen an exam question. What do you do? Take your quiz. How do you prepare for the quiz? This is going to be the next question, right? So the quiz is, the homeworks are counted, the top 5 of the homeworks and the quiz. So 7 different things, 6 homeworks and a quiz, are counted in your grade. So you can like get a 0 on the quiz and get 100 in class. As long as you're really good at homework. Or on the other hand, if you're having a bad day at homework, you could save yourself with a quiz. But that's really not the quiz. So the idea is that the quiz is a low impact way of kind of getting with the idea that there'll be exams, what the exams look like. And it's just, it's late enough that we've already talked about something, and it's early enough that it's not immediately before the midterm. So then you get it back ready. Wait a minute, I thought I had that right. Roll back. Okay? Other questions? Yeah?
In the screening video reading, they talk quite a bit about real player, and they have a lot about real player. Real player is not a Windows Eye product or a Mac product.
That's right. So RealPlayer is a company.
It's a company.
And the business that they're in is providing players for which people create content. So then if lots of people create content, there'll be a business to sell production software. So they give away the players with the idea that you'll buy their real producer. There's a free version of real producer and a professional version of real producer. And if you run a is something like C-SPAN, NASA TV, whatever, you'll buy the professional version. If you're just using it in a class, you'll use the free version of Real Producer. So the business that they're in is providing this this service. But their technology, their base technology, is the same as everybody else's. It's just like Yahoo Instant Messenger and Google Messenger and Windows Live Messenger. At one point they didn't all talk to each other, and it wasn't because they couldn't, it's because for competitive reasons they decided not to. At one point when you installed a new web browser, it would offer to take over your computer and be your favorite web browser, the one that got booted automatically whenever a web browser was called for. And so you get these browser wars where each one was saying, ooh, something happened, it got taken away from me. Here, would you like to make me your favorite browser? So they're still doing that between RealPlayer and Windows Media Player. So when you install RealPlayer, it will offer to be your player for everything. And then when you install Windows Media Player, it will offer to be your player for everything. They have these little default things with beta. Standard installation, and what that means is take over everything in your computer. Or custom installation, you have to answer like 45 questions of no, I don't want this, no, I don't want that, no, I don't want this other thing, and then it will just play the things that are designed for it. So you need them both because there's some content that will only play with each. But they all try to play your MP3s, they all try to play your DVDs. So you buy a nice new computer which will play DVDs with some fancy software, and then the first time you install one of these, takes over your computer and all the DVDs play through it.
Yeah, last time I had my computer looked at, they got rid of RealPlayer and they just let Windows dominate.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So you know that you can read the thing about RealPlayer and then just do all that with Windows Media Player. Right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Yeah.
What's the difference between regular FTP and your FTP, and why can't they talk to each other?
Okay, so FTP was a file transfer program designed for the internet back when everybody was friends. So there was a sort of a culture of you shouldn't use this for commercial purposes, so there wasn't any spam, there weren't any people listening in to see what you were doing, sniffing on the network. It was a bunch of geeks, and the geeks were just interested in developing networks, and they'd send emails to each other so they'd have something to do with their network, right? And they created FTP so they'd have something to do with their network. And so it was all very safe. And then commercial interest came in, and it turned out to be useful to steal your password and sell them to people because, you know, everybody had accounts. And so then what they would do is they would listen to to the network traffic, and they'd ignore everything except the passwords. So when the passwords went by, they'd get that, and then they'd make a list of them, and they'd sell them to somebody who would pay money to be able to break into accounts. And then when they could break into the account, they could put a file on the machine and use it to, for example, transfer illegal content, like, for example, lists of people's passwords, right? So it was sort of, it after a while, it got out of hand. And so the University of Maryland said, fine, what we'll do is we'll use an encrypted version of FTP that automatically encrypts everything, incidental to the transfer. As it turns out, it encrypts the passwords, too. And so now anybody who's listening just hears gibberish going on. And so that provides a higher level of security. Now, of course, your side has to negotiate the encryption with the other side, so it's not such a high level of security that, you know, NSA can't break it. Because, you know, the people on the other end of the communication are receiving it. So somehow it has to be decryptable. But it just creates nonsense in transmission. Now, of course, if you have a system designed to send nonsense, and you connect it to the old-fashioned FTP, it'll look like nonsense. So the new one talks to the new one, the old one talks to the old one. Okay? So, go ahead.
I just have a question on cookies.
Okay.
We talked about them last week a bit, in terms of how there could be a potential privacy or security issue.
Uh-huh.
And I was wondering, I know that there's like an option when you're in the internet, it's very easy like, to delete history and delete cookies.
Yes.
Does that delete all the cookies? Or, okay, it does. I became paranoid, so I was wondering.
Yeah, so let's say you delete all the cookies, and let's say that you had, you clicked Remember Me on some website, right?
Okay, I'll turn it
again. Okay, well then it won't remember you anymore. It has no way of remembering you. So what Remember Me does is it's a sort of a popular press way of saying, I'd like a cookie. So lots of things send you cookies without you asking, but the Remember Me business is, you know, let's do this and let's do it with the cookie. Then you wipe out the cookie and you come back and turns out it doesn't remember you. So every time I go to buy something from Sears, it remembers me, not because I have to do it, because they thought commercially it would be a good thing to just remember everybody, you know, and it turns out remembers my credit card number, which I actually don't like, because I don't care so much if it knows I'm the person that bought the washing machine and now I need a dryer, you know, that seems fine. But the fact that it offers to charge the dryer to my credit card makes me wonder whether somebody who goes out and practices at the vending store now get my credit card number. Okay, anybody want to guess what the number one thing people didn't understand was?
XML.
The world's shortest, muddiest point. Okay. Somebody can drive for a two-letter muddiest point this week. What would that be? TV. You can actually rate that this week. Okay, so why XML? Well, you just have the barest little introduction to XML. So the best question, the best fully formed question about XML was, why would I want to bother doing XML? It looks like it's just a harder way to do HTML. Why don't I do it with HTML? And I was up here giving you all this mumbo jumbo about how HTML didn't really separate appearance and structure, and how XML separated appearance and structure. But that really wouldn't be enough to get everybody to use HTML because as you've seen, and this is somewhere, HTML works fine. You want a web page? HTML, you got a web page. So that's not really the reason for XML. So I showed you that you could use XML to create a web page. I showed you how you could use it to create a web page. But that's not the real beauty of XML. The real beauty of XML is that we know what it means to be a poem. You know what it means to be a standard. And it allows you to say, in a language the computer can understand, this is a poem and that's a poem. Now, if you could do that, think about when you create information, who you're creating it for. In our profession, we normally think that we're creating information for people. People create information for other people. The machine's just sort of an assistant. But there is a whole other profession that thinks that people create information for machines. And so the machines then will do something with the information. That's computer science. Okay? So they like to make machines, and the machines process information, and that's it. Starts with the machine, ends with the machine. Now, surely there must have been a person in there somewhere. So they think database. Databases. So how would you like to have something with the power of a database to answer complex questions, to put together different pieces, but with the generality of text instead of having to architect the database? And so what you'd like to be able to do is you'd like to be able to express in human language what you mean, but express it precisely enough, concisely enough, that the machine can understand. Now, this is a bit of a dream. Don't take this too far. But if you did take it too far, you'd land up with what people call the semantic web. So the most important thing to realize about the semantic web is that it doesn't exist and never will. And the second most important thing to know about the semantic web is it's based on XML. So whatever actually does come to pass will be along that XML path. So you've learned computers, and then networks, and now we want to transfer information over networks. We can transfer them to web browsers using HTML, but that's a dead-end evolutionary path. You can't make sense of them for other purposes. If you want to do more general things, you transfer them with XML. And of course, you can use XML to do web pages, that's HTML, but that's not the main purpose. The main purpose is to express something that's going to be processed on the other end. So this week, I will show you another use of XML. And we could fairly easily, every week, just drop in another use of XML. So XML is an extensible language to people that people just use it when they need a language. Anytime I need to say something to you. Anybody here use Google Maps? Okay. So the way Google Maps works is it downloads a JavaScript program to your browser. So your browsers come with the ability to execute JavaScript programs. We'll learn this in a couple of weeks. And then there's a program on their computer. And when your browser says, I want to see what's over here to the west a little bit, you know, because you dragged it and now it's got to come up with some stuff that's over there, it sends a request in XML to the servers at Google, which send back in XML what's supposed to be drawn on your screen and that stuff. So it's two programs communicating. And of course, they could have made up their own language for it. Why not just use XML? XML is just a way of saying, put it in a field called this. Get it out of a field called this, so that they can package up information. If you know about zip files, the package up files, this just packages up lines of text and gives them names. That's all XML ever did. And so I'll show you an example of that today. When we get to JavaScript, I'll show you another example if you remind me of this. It's called Ajax, the program paradigm. Allows you to run programs on both ends. Got a better idea what XML is about? You just sort of had I showed you HTML, and then at the end I said, and XML mumbo jumbo gives you this, right? It's like, but then what do you learn how to do? Go create HTML. So, I mean, you can, with all, what I'll show you tonight, you can go create some XML that will do synchronization of 20 photographs and an audio channel, so that the slides flip at the right time as the photographs flip at the right time as the audio channel goes on. And you can set all the timing for when things flip. And then you give it to RealPlayer and it plays it. No special software. Because RealPlayer is designed to read a particular form of XML called SMUT. Okay? All right. Let's see. Rebecca asked me to say a couple of things. Is Rebecca here? So she asked me to say a couple of things today. I'm going to forget one of them now. On the homework, if you're coming to lab, she would appreciate it if you would get as far as you can on your own and come to lab when you're stuck. And the reason for that is because she's very appreciative of everybody's coming to lab early and thus has plenty of time. Nobody's showing up at the last minute. But lots of people are coming to lab not having started, and if the homework takes longer than an hour and a half, then she misses her next appointment. She's kind of tight on the 12:30 departure. So this week, I'm going to come to lab at 12:30 so that she can make sure she makes it out. But if you can come to lab as far along as is feasible to be, then perhaps we'll all actually finish by 12:30, and then in future weeks, we'll have that a bit easier. Maybe I'll think of the other questions. Okay, any further questions? All right. So, Heijun Wu teaches a Tuesday class and the Sunday lab. So if you're not, any of our students coming to Sunday lab for this section? Cool. Both labs are available to you. The usually what happens in the Tuesday class is that all of my good ideas and all of the Heijun's good ideas get taught. So the Tuesday classes are better than the Monday classes. He comes in and soaks up all my good ideas, and then he teaches with even better ideas. And so I wanted to show you one of his even better ideas. So this is an in-class exercise that his students did, because I went to his class last week just to sort of see how it goes. And so here's my new and improved webpage. Now, somebody actually asked me about this. They said, wait a minute, what happened to your webpage? Right? And so what happened was his students were assigned to take my webpage and give it a little style. That was the assignment in class, is to go swipe my webpage and jazz it up a little bit. And so when he assigned that, I was like, yes, I don't know what to do this. So before his students could do it, I jazzed it up a little bit. So I want to show you how I did that. So in this, let's just view source. In this web page, there is now one new line. Let's see if I can make that big enough for you to see. Okay, can you see? Is it readable size? Text size? Okay, so it says link, rel is a style sheet, href is my style, .css, type is text slash CSS. That's it. So all that I did was I added mystyle.css, and I said, this thing is going to be in whatever style mystyle.css. And then there's a mystyle.css sitting in the same directory. You all kind of got the trick of that. You got to move things in the same directory. So it's sitting in the same directory. There's a mystyle.css file. And that's it. And so I didn't write this. They didn't write this. He swiped this from somebody else. But this is a style sheet that makes that kind of fancy writing. Right? And you can see what it's doing. It's putting Lucida calligraphy, Don Serif on H1, H2, and H3, and tables and stuff. Okay? So you can just go find somebody else's design style sheet and say, I like that, and there you are. So this is, you know, 2 minutes. And most of the 2 minutes was doing exactly what you guys spent 2 hours doing, trying to figure out how to get something FTP to the right directory with the right class. Right? And trying to figure out which was the right mystyle.css file to swipe. So if you go to Heijun's class webpage, you'll find a list of style sheets. And you can swipe any one you want. Got it? Yeah.
But what's the link rel equals style sheet? I just copied a mumbo jumbo. Alright? In fact, that, it works. So this is a hypertext reference to that, but... The first time I heard it, stop. You put that in your line, it says that's where you find the cell. So you remember, here, let's give you the easy answer. This is a slide from last week. And so this says if you put this in the head of your web page, then this will be a pointer to a page of that name that contains things of that form. Right, this is the cookbook school program. I mean, I can read it to you. It's a, rather than a head or a body, it's a link, right? I know what to do with href because I've seen it before. This is a MIME type, but whether these things can be written in opposite orders, I don't know. I mean, they're just attributes on a on an entry of type length. Good enough. Other questions? Expect much fancier web pages from you next week. Okay. So. That was just for fun, and I'll probably change it back at some point because, in case you haven't noticed through my slides, engineers make very boring graphics. Okay, so here's the basic idea. We talked last week about how to do the web, but it wasn't really the web. What we were really doing last week was how to write text on your screen and how to get it to word wrap. I mean, there's a little bit of, you know, put the image here. But there was none of the, you know, what is an image, or how do I make this into another image, or how do I get rid of the red eye in the photo? I don't know, why is there red eye in the photo? It's interesting. What is a photo? I mean, there's no film in this digital camera. What's happening? What's a photograph anyway? Okay, so we're going to sort of commune with nature and figure out what an image really is. And then when we figure that out, then we're going to figure out what a mood of the image really is. And then we're going to get sound, and it's not going to surprise you that, you know, this is what gives you video, right? So you get the video, the audio, the video is a bunch of moving images. And then the problem is I got to get it to you. And then once I get it to you, I'll show you at the end how you can make this up from still images that you can create it yourself. That's where we go. That's that XML file. So here's a photograph. Now, if you look at it from a distance, it actually looks like the scene you would see if you look at it with your eye. But if you look at it up close, this is what you see. So we often refer to them as dots, but they're not in fact dots, they're squares. So we call them picture elements, or because we're geeks, pixels. So this is simply made up of some white and some gray and some red, some blue. All right. So every one of those chunks, every one of those pixels have a color. Now if I tell you the color of every single pixel, then you could invent a new way of painting by simply painting dots, right? If you paint enough dots and put them close together, it will look to people as if you painted a picture.
Yeah, I actually don't know anything about this, including how to pronounce the artist's name, but Jimmy Lin came up with this one.
What's that?
Toronto.
I can't do the, is it Georges?
George.
George. You see, that's where I keep screwing up, right? So every time I try to look like I know what's going on. Okay. So, this is all I have to show you how to do, and then we're done. You understand images. Right? Okay. That's what engineers do. They break complicated problems down into simple problems, and they solve the simple problem. Right? And then they just put them together to get a solution to the complicated problem. So, if I want to specify a color to you, what do I have to tell you? I want to paint my numbers. Right? You remember that paint by numbers thing? Okay. So I want to paint my numbers, so I have to tell you the number of the color, right? So how many colors are there? What's that?
A lot.
A lot. What happened to Roy G. Biv? Red, orange, green, yellow. No. What's that?
Blue,
indigo, violet. Yeah, Roy G. Biv, right? But there are more than that. Because there could be like light blue and dark blue and... Okay. So, in this picture, there are something like 24 million colors. So how do we actually specify a color? Well, it turns out there are two ways of doing it. Anybody know? Yeah?
RGB numbers.
So those are two ways of expressing it, that's right.
Okay.
So I was thinking about two ways of fooling your eye. There are additive colors and subtractive colors. Anybody know about this? So if I have a red light, and I have a blue light, and I have a green light, and I can focus them on that wall, all at the same point. Imagine spotlights in the theater. And I can turn the red up and down, the green up and down, and the blue up and down. I can create any color on that wall. You know that? Additive colors. Red, green, blue, primary colors. They named the movie after it, right?
Green's a secondary color.
What's that?
Green's a secondary color.
But in light, it's a primary color. So in a primary color is a color can be used to create another color, and a secondary color is a color to create, right? So there is this set of subtractive colors. And this is what you use with paint, right? So I don't remember what they are. Cyan, magenta, and
yellow.
Yeah, okay. So these are subtractive colors, and what they do is they absorb, and so you can take away pieces of the color space, or with the additive colors, you're adding by projecting pieces of color. So the way that the displays work is with the additive colors. So engineers have it easy, that's why we don't have to learn about cyan, that's why engineers don't actually know what color cyan is, right? So we do red, green, and blue, and then we can add them up to make anything else, including, I suppose, cyan. Okay, now, you remember that bit about having to turn them up and down? So what I do is I specify how bright the red is, how bright the green is, and how bright the blue. Right? And then if I tell you that, that tells you what the color is. So if I set them all to zero, what color do I get?
Black.
If I set them all to the highest possible number, what color do I get?
Black.
If I only have two settings, off and on, then my television set is called black and white. Yeah? And I don't really need three colors. I can just turn one thing on or one thing off. So if I want to have all these different colors, I'm going to need to have some degree of gradation. So I could, for example, have 8 bits, 256 possibilities of red, 256 possibilities of blue, 256 possibilities of green, and if I wanted to record that, how many bytes would that take for those 8 plus 8 plus 8? 24 bits. And how many bits in a byte? You only do great, right? That was 2 weeks ago. Okay, so how many bytes? Three bytes per color. That's 3 bytes per pixel. one byte per color, three colors per pixel. With me so far? Good. This is actually how it's done. So if you come up here and look at the original picture, we'll do this over break if you want, you can actually see the pixels. Right, the little squares on the screen, if you get close enough to it. Okay, how many pixels up there? Give me a guess. More than 10?
A lot more than
10. A lot more than 10. Less than a trillion? Hard to know. Looks like a lot, right? Okay, so a typical resolution for a projector these days, this is not a feature of the computer as much as it is a feature of the display. The computer and the display have to be matched, but the limiting technology is the display. So a typical projector these days, this is 1024, and this is 768. That's about 1,000 times 1,000, right? Round numbers? It's a little less, right? That's how many? Million. How many bytes per pixel? Three. How many megabytes for that picture? What's that? Three, yeah, 2.5, something like that, right? 2.5 megabytes to store that picture. How many of you have digital cameras? Yeah. Do you know how big your pictures are? What's that?
23
megabytes per picture? Oh, that's a camera. Really? For each picture, every one picture is 23 megabytes? Do you get some of them by email?
Sometimes
the G-Lite can, but it's got a really big camera. So 1024 by 768 would be 3 megabytes if you just coded it with the simplest possible way. You actually sent all the bytes. We can't afford to do that. You can afford to do that because we have a Gmail. But the rest of us, we want to compress it. If you have an 8 megapixel camera, it has 8 million pixels. Right? Something times something ends up being 8 million. Times 3, 24 million. Too big. So we want some way to compress it. Anybody come up with a way I can compress this picture to use fewer bytes? Okay, so I can not have certain color combinations. The ones you don't use, right? I mean, how often do you use light gray and light gray? I mean, maybe I don't really need 24 bits. Maybe I can get it into 16 bits or something. That'd give me a nice factor of like 30% reduction. Anybody else? Don't buy 8 megapixel cameras, right? Get 2 megapixel cameras. They use up less space. Yeah? Nobody's going to like either one of these, right? Lousy color, lousy resolution, right? Okay, neither one of these is good. So what are we going to do?
Make it smaller.
With lower resolution. So the lower resolution, when I make it smaller on the screen, then I get down to postage stamps. That's actually what they do for video, because I have to send you so many pictures so quickly. That's why the video is postage stamp size. So that's exactly what you do when you get the lousy picture. And then you make it small so it doesn't look quite so loud. Okay, so. Okay, now how much less space can I squeeze into? Because I'm going to have to like unsqueeze it when it gets there, right? How do I do that? How do I take something that takes 24 megabytes for an 8 megapixel camera, and then I'm going to squeeze it so that it takes only 200 kilobytes? And then when it gets there, I'm going to unsqueeze it, and it's going to look exactly the same. So that's what the trick is. Okay, so we talked about this already. Every pixel is a color. If it's a color pixel, it's three colors, 8 bits each. If that 24 by 768 was a 2.4 megabytes, which if you think about it, you could store 400,000 words. So all that stuff about a picture being worth 1,000 words, not true. Worth 400,000. Okay. So this problem first came up when people were sending faxes. What we do is I would have to send you a fax. So I would have my phone call your phone, and then I would feed it into something that looked like a copier on this end, and it would make a chirping sound. It was something like a modem, and it would send the bits to the other end, and then it would draw on the paper the thing that I had on this end. So it was an early image transmission. And the problem was that phone lines were expensive. So we had to have some way of taking the paper, what was on the paper, and finding a way of describing it more compactly. Now, we've got some paper right here. Sure. I'm not going to burn it. I'm going to hold it up. Let's say I wanted to describe this to you. What would be a good first order description?
Mostly white.
Mostly white, right. So why don't I just say it's white, except right here. And I'll tell you the parts that aren't white. So the first thing I say is what color the whole thing is, and then I just tell you the parts that aren't that color. Now, I can't depend on the order of transmission to tell you which part I'm talking about. I have to say this part, that color, this part, that color. So that part gets bigger, right? Because I have to tell you not just what color, but what part of it is that color. But if it's mostly white, this is going to work brilliantly. Right? So this technique is called run-length encoding. So here's an example of run-length encoding. You might have heard that sheep go baa and cows go moo. All right? Now, if I want to send this, instead of saying B-A-A-A-A-A-A-A-A, I'll just say B-A 10 times. All right, 10 times the previous one. So what I do is this thing, I just go white 400 times. Right, I got 400 whites in a row. So whenever I get those, white 400 times. So how much space does that take? Well, I gotta tell you white and then 400. You see how that works? It's just a cookbook way of I'll code it this way, and when you get it, you interpret it that way. We just have to agree. Make sense? Now, if I uncompress this, will I get back exactly the same thing that you put in? Every pixel the same? Yes? No. Now will be a battle. Who will win? Because, just think of moo here. I got moo, so I make it M-O-10-O. Yeah? And then when I get it, I'll just open it, I get M-O 10 times. I get back exactly what I put in. If I do run-length encoding, I get no degradation. I can recode it, decode it. Recode it, decode. What's that? Open it. That's right. So you're ahead of me on the idea, but stick with me on the technology. Okay? So do you see how when I do this, I'll get back exactly the same thing that I started with? Make sense? Because I have an algorithm for coding it, and an algorithm for decoding. Yes? Okay. Nobody uses it. But it gives you the idea. So this is a strategy called lossless encoding. I want to compress it so that it's smaller, send it over to the other side, decompress it, and get back exactly what I put in. It's like something for nothing. Now, there are a couple little problems with this. One is, how long does it take to compress it? I don't know, a little while, right? I got to run a computer program. Then how long does it take to send it? A little while. And then how long does it take to decompress it? A little while. I'm sending three little whiles instead of just one. So if I want to send it to you faster, well, yes, I'm spending less time sending it, but I'm spending more time compressing it and decompressing it. And so if you had a slow computer and a fast transmission line, you would prefer not to compress it. But if you had a fast computer and a slow transmission line, you'd prefer to compress it. And if you had a really fast computer and a really slow transmission line, you would surely love to compress it, and you would compress it just as much as you could, right? Remember the space probe to Saturn with the really slow radio link? Yeah, those people were really into compression because no matter how slow their computer was, their radio link was slower. I remember they did it fast, but let's just try to remember how fast is the computer that you've got here. What's that? Well, okay, if your choices are fast, really fast, really, really fast, and so fast you couldn't possibly believe it, which one would you choose? I go for so fast you couldn't possibly believe it. I mean, it's in nanoseconds, right? Yeah? And when we're sending things across the network, it's up here in like milliseconds or microseconds or something. It's way slower than nanoseconds. The computer's just really, really fast compared with the transmission line. So that tells us we want to compress this thing just as much as we can. We'll work just as hard as you want to compress it. Okay, so here's a strategy we can use. First, we compress it, and then to get more compression, we compress it again. And then to get even more compression, we compress it again. And after a while, we've compressed it down so much that it's not there anymore. I don't think this is going to work, right? There must be some fundamental limit to how much we can compress something and still uncompress it and get back the same thing. So it turns out there is. A bunch of people have studied this. There's a limit to how much you can compress things. The technical term is entropy. But the point is, there's some limit below which you can't compress. And that limit is far short of what the marketplace's demand is. The marketplace wants more compression than you can possibly get. So what do? You start throwing things away, right? We'll have fewer pixels, we'll have fewer colors. Now, it turns out that there are some differences the eye can't see very well. And there are other differences the eye sees just brilliantly. For example, the eye is just great at seeing edges. It's optimized for saber-toothed tigers that are running towards you, right? And the edges are getting further apart, and you're like trying to turn and run, right? So the eye does really well at finding edges. But the eye doesn't do too well at telling whether this is light gray or light gray with a little pepper color added, right? I mean, they both kind of look like gray to you. But two things right next to each other, you might be able to tell the difference. You can tell relative differences much better than you can tell absolute. It's like most people don't have perfect pitch in their hearing. They can't tell what note that was. But they can tell differences between notes. So the eye sees some things and doesn't see others. So this is the other trick. We're just going to throw away all the things you can't see. And then when we reconstruct it, it won't quite be what you put in. So if you measured it, you looked at the bits, they'd be different. But they're not different in ways that your eye can see. Rebecca's here if you've got any questions for her. What were the two things I was supposed to tell them? I was supposed to tell them, be prepared when you come to lab, just like the Boy Scouts, and I did that one.
Yeah. And please don't change your web page until at least Wednesday. Because I won't necessarily have time. Even if you sent them to me earlier, don't do anything until Wednesday.
You could alternately hear this as if you have until Wednesday to actually finish the homework. Don't interpret that. That would be.
Because I might look at them tonight.
Yes.
But I might also not get to them until Wednesday.
There we go.
So.
Better Wednesday.
Thank you.
Good, thanks. OK. So, if we get to the point where we can't compress it any further, we have to start throwing stuff away. So, what we do is we take a different strategy. We throw away everything we can that the eye won't see. And then, we compress it using lossless compression. So, first we compress it by throwing stuff away. And then we compress that further in such a way that when we uncompress it, we get back to the thing the eye can't tell. And we call that lossy compression. And then we run into exactly this problem. That if you save it, and then open it in an editing program, and then save it again, we'll throw more stuff away, which isn't really a very good idea. And so archivists hate this because the bits rot. Right? As you copy things from one format to another that involve compression, you're losing something each time you do it. And the first time, you're guaranteed those things can't be seen by the human eye. But then you ask an archivist, what do your users look like? How many of them look like humans with eyes? Well, most of them. How many of them have machines that you know, take colors of this, take pictures of this in invisible light, and try to, you know, see what was once written on the page under the present writing? And it's like, well, every once in a while somebody shows up and does that. That's why we want the original page. Well, that's why we don't want to throw away things people can't see. Because people are going to take this picture from the Hubble Space Telescope one day, and instead of looking at it saying, oh, what a lovely picture, they're going to say, but wait a minute, the temperature of that star went up by 20 degrees over the last 36 years. A question we never thought of today. So, oh, our lossy compression has compressed this photo in a way that people can't see the difference. And it's like, well, they can take easy. If they're measuring very carefully, if they're doing scientific measurements. So archivists hate lossy compression. And the rest of us love lossy compression. Because A, we can't tell the difference, and B, we don't have to pay as much for disk space. Or wait as long for our files to transfer. And so, archivists, wanting to be like the rest of us, have adopted a middle ground. They have a service copy that uses lossy compression, and they have a preservation copy that uses lossless compression. Okay? Okay. So let me show you, so that's all been sort of the idea. Let me show you what we really do. Here's a lossy compression strategy that works fairly well. What we're going to do is we're going to take a picture that has 24 million colors. That's how many colors you get with, actually, I think 32 bits. So we've got 24 bit colors, 32 million colors. So we've got a lot of colors. And previously what we were doing was we simply put the color of the first pixel, the color of the second pixel, the color of the third pixel, the color of the fourth pixel, up to the color of the last pixel. And then the way we draw them on the screen is exactly the way I learned to eat corn. Now there are two ways to eat corn, right? You can eat corn by going around in a circle and then do the next one and go around in a circle, right? Sort of like a typewriter roller, right? Or you can eat corn the way you're supposed to eat it, where you eat one across, two across, right? So it's the way I learned to eat corn, the way you're supposed to eat corn. The first pixel's up there, second pixel's next to it, third pixel's next to it, all the way up to the 1024th pixel is up in the right upper right corner, and then the 1025th pixel is there. Right? So you see it's a raster, we call it. It's a raster of pixels. It's just a big square of pixels, and we just number them across, and when we get to the last one, the next one is just back and forth. Yeah?
So is there a question? When you rasterize something in Photoshop, what does that mean? What do you do?
So I don't know the Photoshop term, but if you have vector graphics, which we'll get to later, then this figures out the pixels for those vector graphics. So I don't know if that's what Photoshop means.
Yeah, that's what it's doing.
What's that?
That's what it's doing.
Okay. Okay, so this is a raster. It's been rasterized by however it got created. and we simply record all the colors. And each of these has taken up 3 bits, or 3 bytes. Now we can look at the picture, and we can say, hey, there's a lot of white here. Okay, one of my colors is going to be white. And then, in fact, we can actually do this in the previous picture. If I told you you had 4 colors that you could represent this picture with, what would they be?
Blue.
Blue, good choice. White?
Green, red, and red.
Blue, white, red, and green. Okay, and you wouldn't find, I mean, brown, you know, you'd have to make that green or something, right? Be a little sick. Okay, what if I told you you had 100 colors? Do you think you could do that picture pretty well? How about 256 colors? Probably do any picture ever made, right? Within the bounds of reason, I mean, not perfect. You couldn't reconstruct the exact picture, but you could come pretty close with 256 colors. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to make the computer into an artist. It's an artist. It's doing pointillism. Is that how it's pronounced? Okay, pointillism. And the computer's got a palette.
You know, that's one of those things that looks like it's supposed to have eggs, but it's got paint instead.
Right. So it's got a palette. And you can pick any one of the 256 colors and draw a point, right? So that's what we're going to do. So in order to do that, I have to show you I show you a little dot from each of the 256 colors. And then I encode the whole rest of the picture by telling you which color, for all the colors in a row. So you see how now we've got the whole thing down from taking 3 bytes to 1 byte. Because there are only 256 colors, and I'm just telling you which one to put in each spot. So I still have my raster, but now I've made them smaller by only having a color palette of 256 colors. Yes? Okay. So, Jimmy Lin came up with this example. Let's say that I want to say to you in text, this is the text version of this, the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain. Every time I mean A-I-N, I'll simply make a star. Every time I mean I-N, I'll simply make a little caret symbol. So then I could say the R star. N. S-P star falls M star L-Y caret the C-L star. So I'm sending fewer characters, and you can put it back together because I made a palette of common character combinations. So we do the same thing with images, and we get what's called GIF, the graphic interchange format. Okay? So we do lossy compression first for GIF, down to 256 colors, and then we do lossless compression further than that. So we find ways of squeezing it further. So this is a kind of lossy compression, this palette selection. And I'll show you the second trick. Let's say that when I'm done, it turns out that blue is the most common color. Now, if you look back at that picture, that's true. Blue happens a lot. How many of the pixels were blue? Let's say 75% of them. Okay, so I have to pick some code for blue. White was also a fairly common color, so I need some code for white. And red was a color that appeared a little bit. So let's say that 75% of those pictures were, for pixels, were blue, 20% were white, and 5% were red. Okay? Now, if I tried to send that, just that, then what I would have to send you is one of 3 possibilities for every pixel. Right? It would have to be 0, 0 maybe for blue, 0, 1 for white, 1, 0 for red, and I'd be wasting 1, 1, which I don't need a code for, right? If I have 4 possibilities or 3 possibilities, it takes me 2 bits. Yes? Okay, so however many pixels I have, times 2, that's the number of bits I need. If just those pixels are in your photograph. And it doesn't matter whether blue is the most common, or red is the most common, or what. Yeah? Okay. Now, here's the actual code I'm going to use. If I send you a 1, that means it's blue. Anybody hear that program, Name That Tune? I can name that tune in one note. Yeah? If I send you a 1, it's blue, we're done. If it's not blue, what do I have to send you? What's that? But I have to, what do I have to send you first? I can't send you a 1, you'll think it's blue. I send you a 0. Okay, so if not blue, I send you a 0. If blue, I send you a 1. If not blue, I send you a 0. In which case, you have to look at the next bit to find out what color it is. Okay? Now, in my next bit, I can send you a 1, and if it's a 1, it's white. And if it's not a 1, then it's a 0. And I'll send you the 1 next time, it'll be red. Now, if it's blue, it takes 75%. It's blue, 75% of the time, it only takes me 1 bit. So previously, 75% of the time, I spent 2 bits, but now 75% of the time, I spend only 1 bit. If it's white, 20% of the time, previously, I spent 2 bits, and now I still spend 2 bits. And if it's red, 5% of the time, I have to spend 3 bits. That's worse. Previously, I only had to spend 2 bits. It doesn't happen to me very often. Right? So the total, if I'm going to send 100 bits, would be 200 bits, there's 100 colors, be 200 bits here, and here it'd be 130. So, shouldn't be any question in your mind, I shrunk it. It's 130 bits, not 200 bits. The question in your mind is, how do I put it back together? Okay? So, let me try writing some sequence of bits on the board. Really? Is it a
regular?
Try it. Okay. Game with the death. No wonder. Wow. Okay, let's say you get this. Okay? What's the first color? Good. Everybody get that? White? Okay, what's the second color?
Blue.
Great. The third color?
Red.
You got the idea? You can reconstruct exactly what I put in using fewer bits. How did we do that? We took advantage of the fact that the colors are not evenly distributed. Some colors are more popular than others. Not in general, in this particular photograph. So for this photograph, we made up a code that was optimal for compressing this photograph. And then we decompressed it. Oh, no, no. So the first one goes in the upper left, the second one, I have to change the order.
Okay.
But I got it smaller. Yeah. I saved like half the space. But if there are more colors, more sharply skewed, I could save about half the space. This is the second step in GIF. This is exactly what GIF does. It uses a variant of this. This is called Huffman coding because it was developed by, you're not going to be surprised by this, Huffman, right? But the variant of Huffman coding is called LZW. You are going to be surprised by this. There was not a Mr. LZW, but nobody could pronounce it, right? So that's how we got LZW. A variant of Huffman coding in which we had to develop this dictionary in advance here, right? But they developed their dictionary, their list of codes, their code book, on the fly. And in fact, it was so clever the way they do it. Makes things so compact that they patented it.
And so GIF is actually a patented technology. And you have to license the encoding. And nobody wants to do that.
So the usual thing that geeks do, people sat around thinking about it and said, well, why don't we just make an unpatented one? So, you know, we'll just find some other way to do it. That isn't quite what they patented. And we'll give it away for free. So they did. So there are free variants of this called PNG, Portable Network Graphics. But everybody just ignored the patent. Okay, so that's good. So you're only dying to know, like, if that's if what's JPEG, right? So JPEG, what they did was they got a bunch of people who knew about human perception. And they said, okay, tell us how the eye works. Tell us what you can see. Tell us what you can't see. And they called this group the Joint Photographic Experts Group, or JPEG. Except then IBM came along and they said, well, our operating system will only handle three-letter endings. Dot something. So you can't have dot JPEG or dot HTML. And that's why you have all these dot HTM, dot JPG things, right? So dot JPG is just a over abbreviation of dot JPEG, which is just an acronym for joint photographic. Okay. So what they did was they said, how does the eye work? And it turned out what happens is the eye sort of sees the big picture. And then inside the big picture, it sees a smaller picture. And inside the smaller picture, it sees a smaller picture. You think about how the brain's wired, right? It's just a bunch of very simple things that are all wired in a hierarchy. So they said, okay, fine. Find me some mathematics that works like that. Well, it turns out, a bunch of mathematicians sitting around thinking up ideas that nobody really had any good use for. And one of their ideas was something called the discrete cosine transform. So what they do is they take pictures like this, and they block them. Big blocks, and then inside the big blocks, small blocks, then inside the small blocks, smaller blocks, and they code each of the blocks, and you run a slider bar across and say, how much of that coding do you want? How small do you want your blocks to get? And that is the quality setting in JPEG. So GIF has only one setting. How big a palette do you want? And the default setting is 256. But in GIF, if you have fewer than 256 colors, it will use less space for the palette. So in GIF, what you control is the palette selection. In JPEG, and there's not usually a setting for it, it's just automatic. In JPEG, what you control is how fine-grained a block to code. How many bits to allocate to each level. And you do the broadest levels first and come back. So in JPEG, this is done by simply taking JPEG, setting the quality, setting to lousy, and doing a screen capture. And you can see the actual blocks, and you can see what they're doing. They're saying, well, this will all be this color, except this part here, which will be this whiter color. And if you turn up the quality setting, you'd find that there was a bright spot on his shirt somewhere around here, and that these areas wouldn't actually be wonky. So it's just allocating the bits in a way that matches the way human perception is. Make sense? Not that you're going to run home and do a discrete cosine transform. You can run home and do it up and down. What's that? Yeah, and people think you're a little strange, right? Over dinner, you start spouting ones and zeros, you know. You'll be like, you should be able to understand it. I wrote the code book on the napkin. Okay. Okay, so that was that's JPEG, and after they do the JPEG, they do more of this lossless compression. Okay, good. So when we come back, we'll talk about how we display this to you. 10 minutes. Thank you.
Yeah. So, we'll only take that one bit every time.
Okay. White.
Have to take up two bits.
Two bits. And then red.
Three bits.
Three. How can... I know, but how can you only have two of them? What are these two, two and two?
Oh, this is what happens if you do...
Well, another doesn't matter. Well, I don't already understand.
Yeah, actually, the example there is not written right. So if I were to use the ordinary way of coding it, I would have had to use two bits to tell you what color it is. Because there are more than, if there was only two colors, I could do that in one bit.
Okay, I think that's where you kind of lost me. I can't follow this one bit, two bit, three bit thing.
No,
thank you. That's maybe where I'm not translating.
Thank you. I
Okay, so the only thing left to tell you is about how to display this to you.
Well, there's also this bit about how Photoshop works and, you know, how to munge these things and how to scan them in the first place or how cameras work. But the part that you're going to run into the most often is how to display it to you. There are two basic technologies. There's the cathode ray tube. We've got those cathode ray. Yeah, we've got cathode ray tube. Okay, so it's the tube. You see, it's got a tube. This thing comes back here. A little piece of the back here, that's why it's shaped this way. It's got like a cathode, it shoots a ray through it, that's why they call it a cathode ray tube or a CRT, and it just sits here painting on the screen. The part here has got phosphor painted on it, and when I hit it, it lights up. There are three guns in there. There's a red, blue, and green gun, and it's in here dancing across. There's nothing actually moving. What happens is, there are a bunch of people. You ever play those games with magnets that you can distort? You ever take a magnet next to a TV and distort the picture? What it's doing is it's using a magnet to shoot the thing across on the raster. So it goes boop, 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 boop. And it's just done with adjusting the magnetic field. So it's really bad because kids sit in front of these things for like years with this cathode ray pointing directly into their face, thinking they're watching television, but what they're really doing is they're like getting their brain irradiated. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this was a big problem in early TVs. And then these things like, they shatter, right? So when you get upset with them, there's one professor in psychology who studies computer rage. So, you know, what do people do to their computers when the computer makes them upset? You know, so a remarkable number of people smash the keyboard, right? But every once in a while, you ever see the picture of the duck? That, you know, it says strike any key and the duck has this big hammer, right? It's to strike them all. So anyway, one of the things that can happen is the, you know, somebody can get really upset with the computer and only put the fist through the monitor, right? Also, when you throw these things away, it creates a real problem. You know what they actually do with these? They put them on a boat and they send them to like Africa where they've got a really big landfill at a low price. And so we're just polluting the rest of the world with a bunch of old monitors. Okay, so we came up with a much better way to do it. You get these lightweight things. It does the same thing. There's no cathode ray tube. They're nice and light. Works really well in laptops, which is where you first saw them, but they're more expensive. And so that's a flat panel. Right, and then what's happening is a bunch of liquid crystals in there, and there's down this side, there's a bunch of controls, or a bunch of wires coming out. Over this side, there are a bunch of wires coming out. You zap the two wires with the color you want, it lights up that pixel, and you just sit there dancing across the screen doing that. Again, it has to have some persistence, and the problem with these is they tend to have too much persistence. It's like those old radar things on TV, you know, where you'd be watching a war movie and the radar would be going around, and every time it went across, it would make a little green dot.
right? And then the green dot starts to fade out. It came around again, right? So these things have that kind of a problem. They have this persistence problem, and the more modern ones don't. They've gotten past that, but it's not as good for video because you get this sort of shadow. So some purists don't like CRTs for that. So CRTs come in all sorts of sizes, but the sizes are funny. They're different. So in the first place, it's done by the marketing people. So if this is 15 inches and this is 10 inches, what would you call it? 15? Or would you sell it as a 10? You sell it as a 15, right?
No.
They sell it as a 23. Right? So they measure it diagonally. The biggest thing they can possibly measure. Okay, so that's what they measure. But the actual monitor goes outward. So they're only measuring the viewable area. Okay, so that's the way CRTs are done. In flat panel, the whole thing's viewable. So they just measure the whole thing. But they still measure it diagonally. Okay, then the resolution, that's how many dots all the way across. That's not dots per inch, that's dots total. Right. So this projector now is probably 1024 by 768. The very early, what's called VGA, the first video cards, were 640 by 480, so occasionally you'll run into an old projector that will only project that, which leaves people rolling the aisles. The early laptops were 800 by 600. Okay. And now, gosh, you know, my computer runs up here someplace, on my desktop machine. Now, what happens is that as you increase this, the video card starts working harder and harder because it's sending more dots to the same display. So as you increase this, the number of times you can paint the screen every second goes down. Now, anybody know how often the lights flicker in the United States? 60 times a second? How about in Europe? 50 times a second. That's actually why we have two different TV systems in the US and in Europe. They've got one where something happens 25 times a second, and two would be 50. So like a metronome, right? One, two. We've got something where something happens 30 times a second. Okay, so it's really convenient for me to sell you a monitor that updates 60 times every second. Why? I don't have to put a clock in it. I just plug it into the wall, and there's a clock in the wall. Right? So really easy to get that. Now it turns out that if you look at a white screen that is updating at 60 times a second, you will get tired. It's really funny. There's something about the speed at which your eye perceives things that will see that flicker subliminally. So if you want this is for CRT, which is lighting up the screen at that rate, if you want a good refresh rate, you want to be up around 80 hertz. And to get up around 80 hertz in my computer, I've got to dial down the resolution to have fewer pixels, because my video card isn't full. So there's a trade-off between resolution and refresh rate. There's another trade-off that's much more prosaic, and that's between the resolution and the size of the type on the screen. So as I get older, I kind of like lower resolution. Same screen size, it's got bigger height on it. Okay, in CRTs, they tell how far apart the dots are. Expensive CRTs, they're 0.26 millimeters. Cheap CRTs are 0.28 millimeters. So this is something you'll see back in the CRT era as you buy any CRTs, not too cheap. But the real difference between the CRT technologies is that, ever hear of Trinitron, the Sony brand name? The big deal was all the pixels were in lines. And for everybody else, the pixels were like circles. Right? So they had a red line, a green line, and a blue line all together. And then another set. So that's that was the way Trinitron did it. Here now in the flat panels, everything in lines. Yes?
If you had a
faster video card, would you be able to have the higher resolution with the higher refresh rate because your video card is faster?
That's right. Okay. So there's a fundamental limitation inside the monitor of what refresh rate it'll accept. You go any faster than that, you fry the electronics in the monitor, and literally smoke will come out. You can dial something up on the computer. So they figured out that they should disable certain settings. So there are certain combinations that my operating system won't allow, but if you try to run it, you just literally fry the monitor. And then the video card's the other one. The limit there is simply how fast the video RAM is. How quick can I get stuff off the video card and out through the cable? But just how fast can I read it out of memory? Because what's going on here is, you remember all that RAM stuff? There's RAM that the processor uses, and there's RAM in the video card. And the processor, when it wants something to appear in a certain spot on the screen, it just writes it to a certain spot in the video card. The video card just sits here reading the stuff out onto the screen. There's some memory location for every dot on the screen in the video card. Special purpose memory. In fact, there used to be a memory called VRAM, video RAM, which had a port for the processor to write in and another port to read it out. But the stuff got fast enough they didn't have to do that. So now it reads and writes on the same port. Okay. Enough about monitors? Okay. You read output devices for this week? Alright, so the last piece was vector graphics. So everything that I just described looks really bad when you blow it up. Right, so if I have a picture that looks okay, and I blow it up to be twice as big, it might still look okay. But if I blow it up to be twice as big as that, sooner or later, I'm going to just be fuzzing it up. I'm going to be actually seeing the pixel. The pixel that was one dot previously is going to be four dots. It's going to be eight dots. After a while, I'm going to see it. In fact, we were making posters for the Research Review Day. Now, I hope you're all coming to the Research Review Day on Wednesday from 2 to 4:30, when all the faculty members will be standing up there waiting to be examined by you on what it is they do in their research. So if you can make it in early, if you're coming on Wednesday at all, or just come in for entertainment value, then what you'll see is you'll see 30 posters, like 5 demos, and we have a series of talks. Anybody been to Hyde Park in London? Yeah. So we have Hyde Park Speaker's Corner set up. We have an actual soapbox that people will be standing on, giving talks. We have the dean giving a talk. We have some master's students giving talks, PhD students giving talks, faculty members giving talks. Little 5-minute talks with a shepherd's crook that will remove them after 5 minutes. Elizabeth is in charge of all of this. And she was making the posters, and one of the posters looked really nice on the screen, but when we blew it up in a poster, they'd taken a picture and blown it up to be like half of the, this big poster. And it just looked fuzzy, right? Looked awful. When we blow this stuff up, it doesn't look awful. All this PowerPoint stuff I'm showing you. Why doesn't this look bad? The answer is, I'm not blowing up dots. I'm blowing up lines. So when we blow it up, we just blow up the mathematical description of the line and then draw it. So we don't run into problems with resolution. No matter what resolution we project PowerPoint at, if all we have is text and line drawing. Because all that's in here in the PowerPoint file is a code that says, draw the letter T in this position on the screen. And then, for whatever resolution is appropriate for that position on the screen, it draws the letter P. You project it with a different resolution, it draws a P with a higher resolution. Make sense? The mathematical description of the letter P. And you can do that with lines. So this is a contribution from Jimmy, who has drawn elephants for us. I think they're elephants, anyway. And no matter how big you make the elephant, it doesn't look fuzzy. So you can use the Do you get the idea of vector graphics? So obviously the line drawings are like really bad for natural scenes. So
So if you have natural stains, you have to use the raster, and you have to use that. Now, often people go the other way. So did you ever get one of these Word documents? It's one page of Word, and it's got a little logo on it, and it's like 5 megabytes. And it's because somebody took a logo that was the size of the Empire State Building, and they shrunk it down. And that's okay, because now you can increase the size of it back to the size of the Empire State Building, you'll still be okay. But it's holding the whole Empire State Building-sized logo and just telling it to draw it compressed down in the short. So you want to match, when you create a document, you want to match the resolution of a scanned image to the resolution at which it will be displayed. So if you're making letterhead, for example, you don't want to overdo it and scan it at Empire State Building. You want to scan it at letterhead size. But then you don't want to take that and blow it up and make it your corporate banner. You want to go get the Empire State Building size for that. Okay? And Photoshop has been good for changing resolution, which you can always decrease and which is devilishly difficult to increase. So, here's a real problem that will really happen to you when you are making your web pages and when you're doing your project. Let's say that you go out and you take a set of photographs of all of the presidential candidates that come to speak at the University of Maryland, of which we've had 2 so far, plus a daughter. Right? Which compression scheme should you use? GIF, JPEG, or vector graphics are very compressed because you're only specifying the mathematical specification at once. Which would be good?
It depends what you're using the picture for.
Okay.
As you told, if you're going to do print, it's better to use the GIF. Or if you're putting it online, you can use the JPEG.
Okay, so if you care about the file size, which is what you care about if you're doing it online, then you do well to use a JPEG because it gets it compressed, so you can transfer it quickly. But if it's a natural scene, like a photograph of people, then JPEG should be visually appealing. Whether you use GIF or some other format we haven't talked about, like GIF, for doing photographs for printing, where you don't care about the size anymore, now you care about the quality. I mean, the astronomers have one called FIT, something or other image transmission standard. And it's for encoding astronomical images, where they're going to go in and measure colors very precisely and things like that. And so you could, you know, and of course they'll want things in FIT standards. So you might want things in different standards for all sorts of other purposes, but to transfer on the web, small file size, visually appealing, you do well to go with it. What if you find a report card from Chelsea Clinton in her 9th grade class, and you want to scan that to go with your Chelsea Clinton photo? Should you scan that in as a JPEG or as a GIF?
As a GIF.
Why is it GIF?
True colors, or you know, if you look at the edges, there might be like some shades of gray there.
Okay.
Yeah, so
you get really tight compression because the color palette doesn't have very many colors in it. Right. So the GIF will produce a tighter compression. Will it produce a better image?
Yes.
Yeah. Now why? That's the interesting question. Why does GIF produce a better image in that case?
I think because the text is line-based, and if you break it up into blocks, the lines won't be as sharp.
That's right. So what happens is, in the JPEG, where everything is in blocks, it finds the block that's got a character in it, and it just kind of fuzzes up the background near the character. Because it's not accounting for the fact that there's a character there, and it's thinking in blocks, and the character is influencing the way it colors things. So you see this sort of shadow coming around text in a blocky form. Every character's got this sort of blocky shadow behind it. And so text looks bad when it's done with JPEG.
And you will often see people who have made service copies available of materials that are in their archive and have been digitized to nice digitization standards in JPEG when what they're producing is text. It's a really bad idea because A, JPEG is not saving you anything in that case, and B, JPEG is costing you something in that case in terms of the visual quality of the text. So for black and white text, better you should use GIF format. If you have a choice. Yeah.
What about for color text?
Yeah, and so if you don't have more than 256 colors, if you need more than 256 colors for some reason, then you'd run out of a palette.
Right, that'd be the only thing.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's a monochrome, single color.
Mm-hmm.
The main point is if you have a small number of colors, you get nice compression out of GIF,
mm-hmm.
and if you have text, you get harmed by JPEG.
Okay.
And then, this is too easy. What should you do for line diagrams? What if it's scanned? If you're creating it in PowerPoint, great, vector. I'm completely with you.
Because
just
the same thing with text.
Absolutely.
You do a line drawing with data,
mm-hmm. Perfect.
Or you can throw in a trace program vectorizer. What's that? You can throw in a trace program vectorizer, so you can get it in and you can get it in the vectorizer afterwards, and you have a scale lunch.
Cool. Everybody get that?
No.
So you can write a computer program that will look at a bunch of dots and say, hey, I'm a guessing there's a vector here. Yes? Except you have to make a lot of guesses. So it might guess some funny things around the edges.
If it's a line drawing, though, they use the black and white line drawing.
Yes. Okay. Clear why we talked about all that now? How all the pieces sort of wove together?
When are you given a choice to use one or the other? I mean, I know that if I scan a picture in, you know, and I have to, you know, my computer just does.
Oh no, my computer has a save as thing.
Well, it'll say
save as JPEG, save as GIF,
save as GIF. Scan an image, a document,
it scans it. And then you hit save,
right.
and you got a little pull-down thing for file size. You didn't pay full price for your computer.
No,
if you had paid full price for your computer.
I just
Well, or you just select JPEG because everybody knows that's better.
No, because it's only just like pictures or it's a text doc, and I scan it into Word.
So this is if you're scanning the file and saving it, and then separately for you.
So if I was scanning these elephants, I would want to save it as a book for GIF.
I do those elephants in GIF. Okay, so here's an example that you can try. Probably just as easy to try it at home. But you can just go to these web pages, click on them. I'll show you here an example. This will bring up an image. You can save the image, and then you can load the image in Paint and save the image in the other format. So if it's JPEG, you can load it into Microsoft Paint and save it as GIF. And that does the conversion for you. And you'll see the file size changes. And then, so if this is a natural image, you would expect that when you convert this to GIF, this was a JPEG, when you convert this to GIF, what do you think will happen? What's that? It'll get bigger? Smaller? Fuzzier? Try it at home. And you'll see that what happens is, in this case, nothing much changes. The file size stays about the same, and your eye can't see the difference. So both encodings are about equally good for that particular photo. And then you try it on other photos, and you'll see big differences. You can have photos that are in GIF and try to save them in JPEG, photos that are in JPEG and try to save them in GIF. So play around with that. Okay. That was still images. Anybody ever go to one of those old sort of game parlors where you
where they had a set of cards that had pictures on them, and you could flip the cards quickly, and it would look like somebody was running, but you knew all you were looking at was cards that had pictures on them, but it looked like something was moving. That's it. Now you know everything you need to know about video. That's how it's done. I simply show you a picture, and then I update the picture so quickly that you can't see the difference. Now, what's human reaction time? Last one, what's human reaction time?
Blink of an eye.
The blink of an eye? The blink of an eye is? 10 milliseconds. No, 100 milliseconds. 100. 10th of a second. 10th of a second, blink of an eye. So I have to show you 10 pictures per second for you to perceive it as continuous motion. Now, it turns out 10 pictures per second is not quite that. I'd do better to show you 15 per second. And if the motion is very fast, your eye will still see this as jumpy. If the motion is very subtle, your eye will see that as smooth. But if I want even very fast motion to appear smooth, I should show you 24 pictures per second. So, motion picture film in the United States, 16 millimeter motion picture film, the ones they used to show when I was a kid in school. You know, there was a, this is back before VCR, and they had to go get the camera and roll the film, and they'd show a little picture of, I don't know what, like travel log or something. Right? This is the teacher that didn't have to teach. This is back before. Otherwise, every teacher would have to teach. So, this is one step after film strips. So, those were 24 frames per second, and they looked really good. So that's plenty fast. So in Europe, they show 25 frames a second because they have the 50 cycle electricity, and they just take two cycles and call that a metronome pulse and flip the picture and do it again. Since we have 60 cycle electricity thanks to Thomas Edison, then we get the we get 30 pictures a second. So the Europeans get more dots on their screen, but fewer updates. We get more updates, which we can't see, right, after 24. We get more updates, but fewer dots. So our TV systems are less good than the European TV systems for that reason. So our TV system is called NTSC. I don't know what it stands for. It's probably National Television. And we don't actually send in TV 30 frames per second. We send you 60 half frames per second. So I send you the first line, then the third line, and then the fifth line, and then the seventh line. So I send you all the odd numbered lines. And then a 60th of a second later, I send you all the even numbered lines. And then I send you all the odd numbered lines, then all the even numbered lines. It's called interlaced video. Right? Now, it turns out to be very expensive. Yep. So what's happening there is that the persistence of the monitor is not very high, so the persistence there is in your eyeball. It's your eye that's being written on. Your frame is so fast that only a portion of the screen is getting written on while the camera shutters open. And this doesn't happen much anymore. Digital camera taking a picture of a television set shouldn't. I mean, every time I've done it, it comes out fine. But that's what that banding was you're just faster than a frame, faster than 16 per second. Normally, you shoot like 100 per second or something on an old-fashioned camera. Okay, so I'm drawing every 60th of a second, I'm drawing half a picture. Except, it's very expensive to make a TV do this interlacing thing. So all the cameras do it, all the broadcasters do it, but the cheap TVs, they just draw 60 frames a second. Let's throw in the last one drawn on. Right? And so you're really losing half the resolution. Okay. So then they decided they were going to come out with this new HD TV thing. And so what they said was, okay, here's the deal. Everybody will now throw away their television sets. Everybody will now throw away their television sets. We'll give them all $40 coupons. They'll go out and they'll buy something that will make
really good TV into really bad TV, because they have really bad TV now, we're going to broadcast much better TV, but they'll be able to watch it only as bad TV on there, always bad TV, if they don't throw away their television. And they can go out and they can buy a much more expensive television set, just like that, television set, and it will have this really high resolution, 1280 by 720, which was a much lower resolution than we actually had on computer monitors by the time they got the standard adopted, much less by the time they got this out there. But that's what we got now, 1280 by 720, and just to keep everybody from getting too upset over the deal, they made them full frames, which they call progressive scans, so you don't get half frames anymore. Now you get something, I don't know, 1280p, right? Which is 1280 progressive scan. So now you can run off and buy an HDTV, and what you're really buying is something not nearly as good as a computer monitor. And in fact, you can use HDTVs as computer monitors. If you have a Okay, so let's just go back to the simple NTSC thing. That was 640 by 480. How many bytes per pixel? This is pretty easy. Great, you got that one? Good. How many frames per second? Good. You're doing really well with this. So that turns out if you do the math, remember the math stuff? God, that was awful. Oh, I got to tell you, no exam has ever had a question on it that was like homework one. What they all have is they all have things that are just like homework one, except they're about file sizes of photographs. That's enough for the thing. So they still have the awful map, except they're not about text being saved, they're about video being saved, or something like that. So this kind of computation is, yeah, I know. Get the love Excel. Okay, so that turns out to be 24.6 megabytes every second. Well, that's faster than you can write to most disk drives. So you couldn't even store that. So you get one of these TiVos, you know, that stores on disk the thing that's coming in on TV. It turns out to be technically impossible to build because the disk can't write, a cheap disk can't write fast enough to take, to suck stuff in at 24 megabytes per second. Now, let's say that you want to take your TV program and put it on a CD-ROM and send it to somebody. How much of a TV program can you store on a CD-ROM? Well, a CD-ROM will hold 640 megabytes, which is about 25 seconds of television. Okay. If I wanted to store 30 minutes of television, it would take 46.3 gigabytes. That's roughly 100 gigabytes an hour. That's a terabyte every 10 hours. Now, anybody here have digital TV? Digital cable? Yeah, okay, so digital cable is transmitting 100 of these into your home at the same time. So a phenomenally large data rate that is connected to your TiVo that is sitting here working perfectly fine, recording whatever it is you're missing while you're in class tonight. So how do we do it? We have to store an awful lot of data, but we don't want to use that much space. So standard trick for tonight is compression. Okay, good. So how many ways do you know of doing compression? Right? Lossless and lossy. So we have lossless compression and we will have lossy compression, right? Okay. So we're just going to keep playing the same game over, right? I mean, there's only one game here, and that is every time you do multimedia, it's big. You find the next kind of multimedia, it's bigger. You figure out the compression, you just got to compress harder. Okay. So it turns out that there's a really, really, really good trick we can play here. In paper, or in an image, it's almost always wave, right? We just say one dot is very much like the next dot, and we get a lot of mileage out of that. Well, in image, in video, if I've got
Jim Lehrer there reading me the news. And in one frame, I've got Jim Lehrer's face. His mouth's kind of like this. What do you think I'm going to have in the next frame? It's going to go closed or something, right? I mean, it's just going to be exactly like the previous frame, except a little different. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to say, I'll send you the picture. The first one. Right? When you turn on your TV, I'll send you the first picture. Then next time, what I'll do is I'll just take the second picture, I'll put it up against the first picture, and I'll just trace the differences. Right? You ever do this? You just hold two things up, and then I'll just tell you what's different between the two? Yeah. I'll just trace the differences, and I'll just send you the differences. And then you can reconstruct exactly. Yeah, I'll just tell you how many pixels this picture, this dot stays the same for, right? It's just one length encoded through time. The same thing. Okay. So this is called MPEG. Now, I'll give you three guesses why it's called MPEG, but you'll really better get it on the phone. They hired a bunch of people to figure out how to compress motion pictures. And they called them, what do you think? Very good. Wonderful, isn't it? Okay, good. So, it turns out that the MPEG people were not nearly as good as the JPEG people. So, they called the JPEG people in, the JPEG people did their thing, they made JPEG, and they went home. Okay, they made JPEG 2000. They had to come back once. But the MPEG people won't quit. You get MPEG 1. No, if you want better, we'll give you MPEG 2. If you want better than that, we'll give you MPEG 4. And it's like, but wait a minute, can't you guys count? Yes, but they're computer scientists, right? 1, 2, 4, got it? Mm-hmm. So, what do you expect is next? MPEG 7. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, 1, 2, 4, and 7. So, what's the trick in 1? Well, here, I'll show you. 1 is designed for web video. Right? So, it's designed for file download. I send you the file, and then you play. There are three kinds of frames, iframes, keyframes, and D-frames. These are just 30 frames a second, right? Or if I'm sending you web video, maybe it's only 15 frames a second. Whatever it is my video encoder is sending you. Every once in a while, I send you an iframe. And every time I send you an iframe, you get to forget the previous iframe, and the only thing you have to remember is the two most recent iframes. Okay, and an iframe is simply the whole picture. In fact, guess what? It's a JPEG. I just send you a JPEG encoded photo of one of the frames, and then we let a bunch of frames go by, and I send you another JPEG encoded photo of one of the frames. And then I tell you, here's the deal. The thing in between will simply be exactly in between the iframes. So it'll be this keyframe. It's an update to the most recent iframe. So what I'll do is I'll send you the iframe, and then I'll send you every dot that changes. So I just send you this dot, now this. This dot, now this. This dot, now this. As long as not many dots are changing, this doesn't take up a lot of space. Right? Now, if I'm sending this to you, and you drop the iframe, what happens? Picture goes to hell until the next iframe comes in, right? And then we get resynchronized. So if you drop an iframe, this is a really bad deal. That's why it's for file transfer. If I send you a whole file, you're fine. You ever had this experience? You're watching cable TV, digital TV, and it's like fine, and then all of a sudden, thunderstorm or something, and it's like everything down to squares, everything back up? Yeah. So that's what it's doing. It's reconstructing from JPEG the iframe. Okay. So in between the iframes, I have the D frames, and in the P frames, I send you the difference from the iframe. So no matter what happens in between the iframe and the P frame, you can forget about it. The P frame is an update on the last iframe. Okay? So if you have the iframe and you get the P frame, you're okay. You can work forward. Even if you got a little jumbled up in between. Okay. You don't have to remember anything. to do with that one, right? But this is what's going on. Then I have a bunch of frames in between. If you remember, those are the B frames. Okay, so I frame's good, right? Initialization. B frames, between. Right, those are where I send you the update. I'm sorry, P frames. And then D frames. So here's how D frame works. I know where this pixel was here, and I know there's another pixel up here, and so I'm going to guess that the pixels on the frames in between are somewhere in between the two. So if I got a dark pixel here and a dark pixel here, I'm going to guess the dark pixel is halfway in between them. Okay. So we can now predict what's going on in the B frame from the I frame and the P frame in between. So now we're doing forward and backward prediction. It's exactly the basic idea I gave you, except with a much more confusing set of images that I've never shown anybody before, but which Jimmy Lin shows people every year. Right? So this picture is not on the test. But you have the idea? One's not on the test yet.
Okay. So it's just guessing about the
D-frame.
It's not actually receiving anything, it's just guessing the location?
No, it's sending the corrections, but the D-frames are guessed in both directions, okay. Whereas the P-frames are guessed forward only. Okay. Right, so it can see both sides for the D-frame, so it's got a better starting point. But that only works over more limited time frames. Okay, and how often I-frames get sent? This is up to the systems that are doing the encoding. You can have good encoders that send lots of I-frames, but they don't have much compression. Or you can have encoders that have lots of compression, but they don't send I-frames very often. They take a long time to resynchronize if they start dropping this. Okay. So that's MPEG-1. Then the MPEG-2 people come along and they say, well, that was fine for low resolution, but I want something that'll work for television transmissions. So I want something that will handle HD TV resolutions. Okay, so they designed MPEG-2, and if you have digital cable or a satellite cable, you've got MPEG-2. That's what you want, is an MPEG-2 decoder. And it's just sitting there, dialing into a signal, so decoding an MPEG-2 signal that's coming down. Now, the web stuff had to be pretty tightly coded. The MPEG-2 stuff has to be really good. So if the web stuff screws up every once in a while, people go, beep, it's just the web. If the MPEG-2 stuff screws up every once in a while, people go, I want a different provider. Right. So what's on a DVD is MPEG-2. Right? So all the commercial video is MPEG-2. And so it's designed for quality, and it gives up some compression to do. Okay. Then MPEG-4 came along, and in MPEG-4 what happens is you don't get the whole thing. You get the beginning of the program, and the program starts playing in streaming video. And in order to get that to work reliably, they have to pay much more attention to forward and much less attention to back. So now you want to get high compression. And so what they do is they say, pixels are known by the company they keep. So I've got a bunch of pixels here. And here, this pixel, it's going from white to black. I'll bet you there are a bunch of pixels around it going from white to black too. So once I encode a transition, I'll just project that transition to the things around it. So more formally, what they do is they form regions in the same way that the discrete cosine transform works, and they make predictions about what's happening in the regions, and then they send you corrections on that. In fact, there are people that have taken MPEG-4 and used it as the first part of an OCR system, because it's actually trying to find regions that all behave the same, and the regions that all behave the same are the characters in an imaging code. So you can use exactly that front end. So it's taking this idea of regions from JPEG and it's building the coding on top of it. Okay. Happy with video? let's do audio. Everything I've just told you won't work for audio. I mean, I just told you about red and green and blue, and if you draw them close enough together, your eye will be fooled, and if you move the pictures fast enough, your eye will be fooled, and it's like, okay, but what do I do for audio? I'll just buy a cassette and hit play, right? So I have to find some way to make digital audio come out sounding the same, even though the sound isn't there. I have to find some way of encoding the sound. It's the same problem I had with the video, right? But to make that dot come out looking the same, even though I don't really have that color, I had to make it up, edit it. So what we're going to do is we're going to make up the sound. Here's how it works. This is, if you wonder what engineers dream about at night, this is it. It's called Nyquist theory. So what happens is, if I have a wave, like I have on an oscilloscope, you know, I take an opera singer, I put a microphone in front of them, and I plot the results on an oscilloscope, and you know what that's going to look like, right? It's going to look like this big wavy thing. Yeah? Okay. So if I do that, then what I do is I say, well, look, I'm going to do the stupidest thing you can think of. I'm going to measure how loud the sound is at different times. And then I'll have a speaker, and I'll just make a sound that loud at the right time. And it'll sound just like your opera singer. Okay, now look, if I do this every second, it's not going to work, right? It'll just sound like different beats and boops every second. So what if I do it every tenth of a second, every hundredth of a second, every thousandth of a second? How often do I have to do it to recreate the sound exactly? Okay, no electrical engineer can correct. So it turns out this is what Nyquist figured out. Anybody know the range of human hearing? You know, like you have really low frequencies. You have really high frequencies. Anybody know the highest frequency a human can hear? Anybody on the dog whistle? Anybody know what a dog whistle is? It's a whistle that's at a higher frequency than any human. So there must be some frequency like that, right? Okay, so it's about 20,000 cycles per second. It's going back and forth 20,000 times every second, right? So I got a really fast oscilloscope, I can see it going up and down 20,000 times a second. With me so far? Okay. Nyquist figured out that if I can sample the top and bottom of every one of those, 40,000 times every second, if I want to get the really high frequencies, I can reproduce it exactly. Now, what do I mean by exactly? I mean, when you draw it on the oscilloscope, it looks identical. Doesn't look similar. It looks identical. As long as there was nothing varying faster than half the sample rate. So I take the highest frequency, I multiply it by 2, and that's my sample rate. Now, I had to go to school for like 24 years for it. We just got it in 5 minutes, so much cheaper delivery, I promise. But that's it. That's the end of the story. Sample at twice the highest frequency. You get it sounding exactly like that. There are a couple of tricks about you have to put filters on to get rid of artifacts, but that's what you hire engineers for. They make sound cards that have the right filters on. I can reproduce it exactly. If I sample it twice the highest frequency, and the highest frequency you can hear is 20,000 hertz. Now, if you're younger, it's higher. If you're older, it's lower. Right? So 22,000 hertz. So here's what we do. We sample at 22,000 hertz, or kilohertz, or 1,000 cycles per second. And we sample it. At every point, we just sample how loud it is. And we encode that loudness in 2 bytes, 16 bits. We encoded it in 8 bits. You could ask your quantization noise. So we encode it in 16 bits. And that's exactly what's on the CD. 22,050, which is 44,100 samples per second. 22.050 kilohertz is the sampling.
And as long as you have no dog whistles on the CD, you're fine. It reproduces exactly.
Audio files have fake arguments about whether CDs sound just like the original. Engineers have no such argument. They sound just like the original. The audio files have a good imagination. We have a civil service.
Okay?
Cool.
Yeah.
Why is it when I, you know, encode something, I can see about 48,000?
See 48,000
or I mean that's an option for encoding.
Oh sure, no. So I'll give you a lot more options.
Okay.
So now let's say that I only want to encode speech, right? So you know the telephone systems are designed by men, right? Back in the old days, and men's voices don't go above 4,000 hertz. So we can just cut it off at 4,000 hertz and we'll be fine, right? So that's what we do. So if you encode speech, what you do is you encode at 8 kilobytes per second, 1 byte sampling, which is fine for reconstructing speech, and everything's fine. Okay. Few women's voices go above 4 kilohertz very often. Right. So, I mean, almost all speech goes through this just fine. That's a really nice telephone. Real, you know, I was a ham radio operator when I was a kid, and we did 2.1 kilohertz. So we were really, you know, half this size. And there you lose the essence of it, which are the highest frequency component.
So you wouldn't hear, if technically a woman's voice was higher than...
You wouldn't hear that part.
You wouldn't hear it. Okay.
You wouldn't hear the thing said there. But your ear fills in. I mean, if I say something to you and cut out 100 milliseconds of it, your ear just goes right over it.
Okay.
Right? You just, because you know what's being said. Mm-hmm. It's just like if somebody mispronounces something, you still get it.
Okay.
Right? Okay. So if you're... If you're, you know, doing sprints, I can hear a pin drop. Remember the old sprint commercials? That's, you know, okay, they're playing with 5 kilohertz, right? So they're spending more money to give you better service. Right? And then their advertisement is you can hear a pin drop. Why? Because the pin drop's high frequency. Right? The high pitch. Okay. So for music, you need like 22 kilohertz. For speech, you need 4 kilohertz. So that's 8 kilobytes per second or 172 kilobytes per second. But you can't get enough seconds on, you know, on your disk file. So actually CDs are stored uncompressed at that rate. Because when they first built CDs, they had processors built into them that were too slow to do the decompression. So CDs actually store uncompressed. But all the, you know, this stuff, this is doing coding, so this is 8 kilobytes per second. This thing's coding well under 1 kilobyte per second. Which is why somebody calls you on a cell phone and sometimes it sounds like they're calling from underwater. That's what's causing it, is that they're slicing out all kinds of stuff to try to compress it. So now here's the question, how do you compress speech? You see the pattern here? I tell you how to do it in a naive way, and then we just do it in a naive way. And then, it's too big, so we compress it. We don't have to be smart in the beginning. We have to have two kinds of people. People that know how to sample things so that they look the same when you recreate them, and people that know how to compress things. Okay. So here's what we do. It turns out that if I whistle for you, let me try. Hear that? Let's try it a little louder. Hear that? So the first one was below your perception, the second one was above. Try whistling in. Hear that? Hear that? So the loudness of the sound that you can hear depends on its frequency. You got little hairs in your ears that vibrate, that's what actually happens. And the different hairs are tuned for different frequencies. And the loudness of the sound that you can perceive depends upon how much you gotta get that thing moving. So, and as you get older, the hair size. So this bass thing moves. But here's the how loud it has to be before you can hear it. So for frequencies above
2 is below 5 kilohertz, it doesn't have to be very loud. In fact, up to about 5 kilohertz, human hearing is pretty good. And down to about 500 hertz, or half a kilohertz, human hearing is pretty good. And to hear things at very low frequencies, things have to be very loud. And to hear things at very high frequencies, they have to be very loud. So this is, I told you, it cuts off at 20 kilohertz. What that means is, it's got to be really loud to be heard at 20 kilohertz. Now, these lights in the ceiling are vibrating at 60 hertz. And it's really loud in here at 60 hertz, but human hearing can't hear it. Okay. If they were vibrating at 400 hertz, you'd be able to hear it. In fact, in airplanes, we use 400 hertz, but the engines are so loud, you can't hear the electricity. But that's why we do it, because then the transformers are loud. So this region here is the region in which human speech works. Now think about that. This is evolution at work, right? Your hearing's not good in the range where people speak. You have a competitive disadvantage for the people who can hear when somebody says, run, saber-toothed tiger coming, right? Speech has survival value, right? So you would expect that the kinds of frequencies people can produce, which is what the vocal cords vibrate at, are the kinds of frequencies people can hear. That's, you'd hope it would be matched that way, and it works out that way. And this is why we can kind of cut things off around 4 kilohertz. Right? Can't hear stuff up there. Okay, so step one, lower the resolution. This just means, you know, knock down the sampling rate. Step two, it turns out there's a really clever trick. People can't hear stuff up here anyway, right? So if it's this loud, it's below the threshold for hearing, nobody can hear it anyway, we just won't send it. We'll just do an analysis. We'll find all the signals in this frequency band that are very quiet. Well, you won't bother sending them to you because you can't hear them anyway. You don't have to be too fancy to do this. Okay? And here's the really tricky one. If I have a hum on my telephone, you ever get one of the telephones got a hum on it? And then somebody calls you up and they go, and you don't hear them because they just made the same noise as the hum, right? But if they said, wow, you'd hear them because they made a different sound, right? So your ear does very well when the frequencies are different. You can hear two things at the same time. Try this sometime. Go to a cocktail party. And just sort of tune in to different people. Your ear does really well at hearing things if they're different frequencies. Right? So, what happens is, when you have a hum, like here, it keeps you from hearing things that are the same frequency, because it's using up those little vibrating things in your ear. But the little vibrating things in your ear that hear this frequency are also used for all the nearby frequencies. So the threshold below which you can't hear anything goes up near the hum. Similar frequencies you can't hear. So now imagine, here's the singer, they're singing Aida. They're going, or whatever they do in Aida. Everything near there can't be heard because this big wah is taken over your ear. Well, fine. We'll just stop sending you the rest of it. As long as they're whine, we'll just send you a wah. When they stop whine, fine. We'll give it back. Right? So we dynamically adjust the threshold in the vicinity of the masking signal so that it looks like this is the threshold rather than what your unmasked threshold would be. Got it? Well, we're sitting here doing all this computation in real time because we have more computer than we know what to do. Okay? Okay. This is called MP3. Now, you remember the people with the MPEG-1 and the MPEG-2 and the MPEG-4, and you're like, where did MPEG-3 go? This isn't it. If that would have been too logical. It is the same people. That's what the MP is. The Motion Picture Experts Group somehow got into the sound business. So, this is perceptual coding for sound. Right? Where we have the things about the perception that tell us what we need to code and what we don't. By the way, the sound in a normal MPEG-1 is MP2, which you never see. That's the sound channel of an MPEG-1 video stream is MP2. And the alternative that's allowed by the standard is MP3. Standard is MP3. And MP3 developed its own sort of standalone color in the audio monitor. Questions? Somebody have a question? Okay. That turns out there's more going on than that. So here's another one. If I have some masking signal and I take it away, remember I showed you the masking signal before? I take it away. Your ear doesn't immediately start hearing other signals. It takes a little response time before your ear's ready to get back to business. And so you can measure what that additional loss looks like over time. And so we eliminate sounds below the threshold of hearing always. We eliminate all the ones that are masked. We eliminate the ones that are masked because of this decay. And it turns out that human hearing is designed to give you good directional coverage on high frequency. So you can tell, if I give you a high frequency sound, you can tell right away, you'll just turn to it. You do this with babies, right? You make a high frequency sound, they'll turn to it. If you make a low frequency sound, like a car going by or something, they'll just look all over the place. They have no way of knowing which direction it's coming from. The reason for this is not because of a weakness of the human ear. This is a fundamental weakness of physics. As the sound gets to be lower and lower frequency, the distance in the air becomes larger than the head. And so no longer can the ears detect the differences. So humans don't have stereo hearing at low frequencies, only at high frequencies. And so you can get some savings in perceptual coding by not coding the second channel, just giving both the same low frequency. And that's all that. Give you one more and then we'll finish with this. Maybe. Now, let's break here. Take a 5-minute break and we'll come back at 10.
I'm going to do that slide, but you know, I have a good question for you today. Are there
Okay, so I met one student on break who either said it was awesome or awful. I'm not sure. So, last topic for compression is compressing speech. It turns out that speech is produced by a set of the way that you shape your mouth, the way that you shape your throat, the way that you vibrate your vocal cords, and this is the really weird one, whether you're stuffed up. So there's actually a resonant cavity in your sinuses that is intended to help you shape a broader range of speech than you otherwise would. But all those things together can't produce very many different sounds. Right? There's just a certain number of things you can physically do. So instead of trying to figure out all the hearing side, which is what the perceptual coding does, what we do is we model the generation of speech. So we predict what the next thing you will say will be based on what you just said, because there are only certain motions that all this stuff can make. And so we can get much, much tighter compression if we know what we're compressing is speech. Make sense? Okay, so what we do is we guess what's coming next, and then we send the corrections. This is called LPC, or linear predictive coding. So this is what real audio does when you have the audio in the class. I have an example here. Let's see if I can get this to play. So this is a web page you can play at home. They took the same speech and they used a standard, this is somebody's research, a standard set of coding schemes that they've published in their paper. And then they record the speech, and they recorded it increasingly tighter and tighter and tighter compression. So it's just like the JPEG, that they're throwing away things you can't hear, and then after a while they start throwing away things you can hear. All right. So let's see if we get this thing to play. So here the original is 64,000 bits per second, 64 kilobits per second. And so this 4 seconds of speech, let's see if we can hear it. People who do this, they're really careful about getting all the S's and T's and L's and everything in there, and they don't really care if it makes sense. You, of course, have the opposite problem. You're trying to convey something that makes sense, and you don't really care if it has any T's, but they do. Okay, so again.
A lathe is a big tool. Grab every dish of sugar.
Okay, you can tell where these people are. So here is something that is compressed by a factor of 8 using conjugate structure and algebraic code excited linear friction.
A lathe is a big tool. Grab every dish of sugar.
Should make you happy you know these people, right? You don't have to learn what that is. You can just get some of their conjugate, whatever it is. Okay, here's the LPC-10. This is the tightest coded stuff. This is 26.6 times smaller. 0.3 bits per sample.
A lathe is a big tool. Grab every dish of sugar.
You hear what happened here? We've compressed it so much that we're sort of clipping off the edges of... You see, you can still tell what's going on. This is what cell phones do. Cell phones just crunch that down as much as it can, send you that minimum, and then if they have extra bandwidth with more bars, they send you some extra stuff so it sounds better. That's why cell phones, when they start getting squirrely, they try to get enough through for as long as they can. This noise has an interesting characteristic. If you listen to it, it sounds a little like music.
A lathe is a big tool. Grab every dish of sugar.
Right, so if you go any further, you'll end up with what sound like musical notes. Guess what happens if you encode music using this? It acts like it's speech. It tries to predict what's coming next. It gets it horribly wrong, and it makes music, but not the music you put in. It makes some other music, right? So that's why when you were reading that real video, real producer thing, and I was going like, this is really complicated. How you compress the audio makes a difference. You have to decide whether it's going to be music you're getting in, and you want a lot of compression, you know, MP3 sort of things, or whether it's going to be speech you're getting in, and you want a lot of compression. Because you get much better sounding speech if you tell the darn thing it's speech with something. And so every semester, when we record this class, the first class of the semester is totally botched. Because we got to learn how to set up the real producer, especially real producer running in the back there live while we're doing this. And it's got all sorts of weird acoustics. And we actually record this not as speech, but as music. Because if we recorded it as speech, the reverberation in the room would kill it. So we're using the music coder. Now, if you wait 5 years, we'll have a reverb speech coder. Because rooms like this are not uncommon. Okay. Got the speech coding down? Okay. See if we can do something useful.
Now, one of the things that I wanted to illustrate today is how to make a narrated PowerPoint presentation, such as the one you're hearing. The way you do it is first you create your slides so that they say what you want to say on the screen. Then you simply select slideshow menu, record narration in the menu, and it would be good to set your microphone level that checks to make sure your microphone's plugged in and gets it too close to your mouth, things like that. Then you just record the narration. Now, this is a little different than talking to an audience, but you can actually record your narration while you're giving a talk to a real audience. When you do this, the slide transitions are automatically captured. So you do this by playing the presentation, and then the transitions will be made automatically. And to play it, all you do is just start the replay. When you get to the narrated slide, the narration will begin. When you get to the last slide after the narration, then the narration will end. Any questions?
It really makes me wonder why we bother giving the course over and over every year. We can just do this.
So this is very effective. I've seen this used. I actually saw this used in a professional presentation with a room with like 200 people in it. But the guy that was supposed to come talk to us, but couldn't make it because he was in Iraq. And so he sent us a narrated PowerPoint to talk through what was going on. You know, just looked at the slides, and it was in his voice, and we'd all met him the previous time. So it works very well if you know the person. It doesn't work very well if it's just a PowerPoint talk to you. It doesn't work very well. Now, you notice that there was no video there, right? So the beauty of that is the audio and the slide transition automatically synchronize. You don't do anything. You just talk, flip the slides, it records everything. So when you play the presentation, it just plays. It flips the slides, says everything you want. So, very nice, built into PowerPoint. And of course, what it's doing is it's playing with great sampling and compression and stuffing it into the file someplace, right? Okay. Now, I wonder if we're going to get this. Now, okay, so this shows you a problem I hadn't intended to show you. This is a video. And what the video is doing is it is reading a file off your disk. You can't stop the video in PowerPoint. And foolish me, I didn't download the video. Hold on a second, I'll download it just yet. Just to show you how it works.
Each mission has their own unique timeline. Each mission has their own unique timeline.
Picture now.
Each mission has their own.
Okay, so I got no idea why. Try it, it's supposed to work better.
Each mission extended the envelope of discovery.
It's supposed to be saying. You can see here what's going on. It's an MPEG video. PowerPoint knows how to play an MPEG video. It looks to the file, it brings it in, it has a little initial file in there. Or a little initial copy of the picture in there, which shows you if you don't have the file. And it was set up to auto start, so just insert movies and sounds, and if it's sitting on your hard drive. But now the problem, as you saw, is you have to copy it to the hard drive so that it's sitting in the place that you told it. And this one was told, maybe. It was told it's in C:/MPEG, so whatever is in C:/MPEG when I set it up, whatever is in that will be played. Okay, so much for glitzy demos. Here's the second to last piece of class. If we don't get the last piece, we'll do it at the end of the class. The fundamental problem with all of this is not moving this stuff over the internet. The internet backbone got way overbuilt. There were companies speculating on the future demand for bandwidth that went off and built internet backbone and now sell it at ridiculously cheap prices because the demand never materialized. This was in the dot-com boom, right? So one of the reasons why the economy did reasonably well after the dot-com bust is because there's all this cheap bandwidth out there and people are figuring out how to use it. One of many factors. So there's a lot of bandwidth on the backbone. The problem is in bandwidth to the desktop, right? So I have to get bandwidth through all the routers and to you. And the biggest problem is the last mile.
because I got to pay that price for every single person that wants to use it, whereas I only have to buy a backbone once and everybody gets to share. So, what do you get?
Well, back when, I was a kid, you'd buy a 300-bit per second modem. But in any case, at the end of the modem era, people were buying 56 kilobits per second modems. Now, you got to watch out for this. This is a 56,000 bit, not by bit per second modem, but it's not really 56,000 because it's only 56,000 rules per after maximum theoretical rate, expected rate, way slower. So the real rate through real phone lines turned out to be about 3 kilobytes per second. Now to compare that, if you run off to Bell Atlantic or whoever, Verizon, I guess, in this area, and you get a digital subscriber line, and you buy the cheapo version, which is 384 kilobits per second, or the slightly more expensive version, which is like 720, then it turns out there's a really nice sort of factor of 10 you can apply here, because to send one byte takes 10 bits, not 8, because of the way they're coded for advertising. That's about 38 kilobytes per second. So it's about, 12 times faster. But this is really agonizingly slow. So it's okay. Except uploads. You can't upload as fast as you can download. So it's slow. Same thing with cable modems. You can't upload as fast as you can download. And if you convert all the advertising literature to what really happens, you get about a megabyte a second or about 25 kilobytes. So moving audio around is okay. Moving video around ain't going to happen. There's no way to send you video and have it get to you while you're still interested in seeing the program. Right? It just takes too long to download the thing. Now, we can download it faster than you can watch it, so I can send you a second of video in less than a second. But if you want to see an hour of video, you're going to have to wait 20 minutes for it to get there. So what I really want to do is I want to send you the first second of video and then play it for you. And then while you're watching it, I'll send you the second second of video. And then while you're watching that, I'll send you the third second of video. So it's because of this slow speed that we have to do this streaming. We have blindingly fast modems. We just send you the whole file we could play. Okay. So this is the way that the, has anybody played one of these classes? On the, you know, gone to the video on the webpage and played it?
Really?
Should I stop putting them up? Okay. Was it audible?
Yeah, it's a little fuzzy.
You could tell what I'm saying if you did.
Yeah,
okay. So, how long did it take before it started playing?
A while.
A while. Yeah, that says what it's doing is it's sitting on a web server, it's a file. You say play, it says okay, go get the file. When it's got the file, it plays. So, it goes to the web browser, and on HTTP transfers, just the same thing that would be used for a web browser, it sends you 32 megabytes of video from the web server to the web browser, and then the web browser fires up the media player and says, play that. Right? That's how this is wired. That's stupid. Nobody in the right mind to do that, because these days what you do is the web server says, hey, there's some video at this URL. Go get it. And then the media player gets told to go get it. It connects to the streaming server, so this could be Real Player, or this could be connects to the streaming server, gets the first second, and while it's playing the first second, the second second comes in, so it's just, it's got a service especially designed to stream. Now you can download those for free, the streaming service. So you can set up a streaming server on your own computer, but your computer would have to have a static IP address so that every time, so you tell it to connect to this, address, it actually could connect to it. So you couldn't be on a DHCP connection where you get a different IP address every time where you're releasing an IP address. Dude, we actually got the entire file. We got disk speeds, we got leased IPs, we got wet data. Okay, got that? So I can set one of these up on my desktop because I've got a static IP, but you couldn't set one up on your laptop on the university's net. Or if you had Comcast at home, you couldn't set it up because you're always leasing IPs. Okay, and then here's what happens. The big trick is you need a buffer. What's a buffer? It's a place to put stuff while you're waiting to display. How is a buffer different from a cache? In concept, no difference. Just call it a buffer. All right? So a buffer, we tend to think it comes in one end, goes through the buffer, comes out the other end. A cache, we think it all comes in at once, and we take out the parts we want. That's the difference in usage. Buffer implies first in, first out. Otherwise, similar idea. So engineers like to use these kinds of diagrams. Here's how much data I've sent you. Here's how long it's taken. So if I'm sending you some video, I send you more video, it takes longer. Even more video, it takes even longer. Even more video, it takes even longer. That's not surprising, right? Okay, how long does it take to get through the network? Well, sometimes it gets there fast, and sometimes it takes a long time, right? So the network delays are variable. So this is a very nice stair step, but this has some long delays and then some short delays, right? See what's happening here? So this is how long does it take to pump the stuff out? This is how long does it take to get through the network? And then what we do is we just wait until some amount of time later, and we start playing, and we just play it out at a nice even rate. And the buffer has a lot in it or a little in it at any given time. As long as the buffer never gets negative, we're fine. See how it works? Yes? The heads go this way, but it's yes. Ask the question.
Well, I don't know
if I said,
in theory,
yes. Got it. Okay, good. Okay, so we do the buffering on the client side, right? The server sends us the stuff and we buffer it on our end. I might buffer mine differently than yours because we might see different network calls. So if you can actually try this. If you have two computers at home, you can watch the same program on both computers, same live streaming program, and it'll be running at different times because your buffers will have different times. But every time my buffer gets to zero, what do? And then it starts again after a while, right? When the buffer's full enough. So when the, but eventually what'll happen is that I'm hearing last week's news. I mean, if I keep increasing it, then I never decrease it. So every once in a while, what I have to do is I have to take the thing and go, and then it's back to normal. I have to speed up the replay to squeeze it to the right. So if I want to take this and move it to the right, I just do it by stopping for a while. If I want to take this and move it to the left, I have to accelerate. Or just chop something out. So every once in a while you're watching a program and all of a sudden, whoop, it's like you missed a commercial or something. Just kind of caught it. That's what happens when the buffer gets controlled. Okay, so if you're in the map, here's what happens. Every chunk is a time step Q, T, and it's played out at time T plus Q. If it arrives after T plus Q, you'll throw it away. I just said the same thing except I used T. So, this says I can't make it any longer. Once I'm not willing to make my Q any longer, if I don't have it, I just skip it, go on to the next. So if I'm sending you packets, and I have a packet that gets lost, I don't wait for you to resend it. I just ignore it and go. So what can cause it to get lost? Well, you could be on the Ethernet and packets can collide and bam, it's gone. Never gets heard. Two people talking at the same time on the same line, lost. Or I can simply delay it for too long until the time you need to play it, I'll just throw it on the floor. So in addition to everything I told you about compression, we have to design these systems so that a 1% packet loss does not cause everything to fall apart, because 1% packet loss happens a lot. And I can design a compression scheme that will tolerate a 10% packet loss. You remember I told you in MPEG that you get to design how many iframes you put in? Iframes make your bandwidth larger, but they allow you to resynchronize sooner. So this is the sort of an idea you can do coding schemes that are tolerant to packet loss. They go crazy, but only for a little while. Okay, so this is really fun. And you should do this at home. Fire up C-SPAN. Pick something you want to see.
So let's look at President Lincoln's Cottage Grand Reopening. We'll hit watch. Get our real player, which will very soon have...
Live down to the reopening of Abraham Lincoln's cottage here in Washington. The 34-room house located 3 miles north of the White House was a retreat for the nation's 16th president during the Civil War. It's been restored by the National Trust for Historic Preservation.
Okay, and then we go to tools.
Tomorrow. Live coverage just getting underway.
Playback statistics? We don't really want to see the cottage. We want to see the playback statistics. And we can look and see our packet loss rates. So we received 99.75% of the packet.
We acknowledge our one of our Lincoln scholars, Matt Pinsker, and Matt is...
we recovered some of them.
He's an expert
on... The late packets we have, none.
And what it has meant...
Okay, so there are big packets, we got late packets. We've got no lost packets so far. If we watch it long enough, we'll have some lost packets, particularly if we get on a wireless connection.
And he's just one of a number of Lincoln scholars who are here with us today. That'd be great.
87 recovered packets?
Doug Wilson, I believe.
Oh, I got 13 totally lost packets.
Yeah.
You get the idea? So you don't really have to look at the video. Engineers look at the playback. You can also look and see how your bandwidth is going. So here's your target bandwidth. They were sending you too much stuff, and then they throttled the bandwidth. And you can see we had a little network problem here. All right. And then it kind of caught up, so the bumper had to bring us through here.
We've got a great group of educators
here.
Season in action this week. I think they're ready to go.
Anyway, great folks.
Tomorrow morning.
You can look at this for hours. In fact, you can flush our flats and watch this.
I want to especially recognize the services of three.
If you would take out a piece of paper, and if you'd write on it, please, I understood everything you said, not whatever the muddiest point was, and leave it with me. And the muddiest point is this has been just a wonderful way of getting back in the mood for class. Anybody have questions? I'm happy to stick around. Yeah,